Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast for people heartbroken by historical inaccuracies. If we should stumble across an incompatibility between what we're led to believe about the ancient world and the truth, then you'll hear this noise. That's the gavel of truth smacking down on historical lies. Now, today we'll be talking about a hot topic in the current world, messy breakups. Yes, in recent weeks we've been all aware of a celebrity relationship breakdown. Yes, we've heard all the details in great depth and probably feel like we could do with a break from that particular court case. So now that it's over, I've invited my friends over so we can have a DMC, a deep meaningful conversation about splitting up. Bringing the ice cream, we have Xenia here to cheer us up with gossip from ancient Rome. She's bringing the wine, that's right, we also have Meg with us today to talk all about the messy splits that happened in ancient Greece. And Barney's on chocolate duty as he distracts us all with stories about the death of love in the ancient Near East. They say all good things must come to an end, so that's your list of ancient history experts. Now I'm left to introduce myself. I'm Flo, and I don't know much about the ancient world. However, I do need closure on the subject of ancient breakups.
So I'm going to presume that in ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and in the ancient Near East, you couldn't get divorced?
I'm going to immediately go against the law and say, yes, you absolutely could get divorced in ancient Rome. It was actually fairly commonplace. It was so common that the Emperor Augustus had to put in kind of extra laws to keep people in nuclear families and try and encourage them to have children together instead of just like going from one advantageous marriage to the other. And a lot of these marriages, obviously, especially in the upper classes, were political. I mean, it's quite funny because Octavian himself had three different wives, so he couldn't really talk.
At the same time, or?
No, one after the other. So bigamy was illegal. You really weren't supposed to do that, although adultery for men was not a crime, but it was for women. And that could be grounds for divorce. And in that situation, the woman would have to give half her dowry back. But the dowry is actually quite an important aspect of ensuring women's independence. You know, it's just a certain amount of security for women within a marriage.
So is that true in ancient Greece and the ancient Near East as well, that divorce was actually fairly commonplace?
Yeah, ancient Greece. I mean, I wouldn't say commonplace. It was rare. We don't have a lot of sources. There's not a lot of evidence for divorce. But it was easy. If you were an Athenian man, getting a divorce was easier than like half of the other things you'd have to do in your life. If you're a man and you're married in Athens, all you have to do to get a divorce is send your wife back to her father's household. Just, you know, pop her on a horse, send her home, and that counts as divorce.
It sounds like both in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, it sounds like you're just like being grounded. But go to your father's house. I don't want to marry you anymore. Yeah. Not my wife anymore. Get out.
Exactly.
Okay. And Barney, what about the ancient Near East?
So this is a full triple against the law here.
Oh my goodness. A triple fail.
Exactly. Any like preconceptions that we might have about divorce from, say, the Middle Ages or the early modern period, Victorian England, whatever, don't seem to apply quite so predictably to the ancient world. And in the ancient Near East, women could get divorced from their husbands and they could initiate divorce as well. And there's quite a lot of focus placed on the words used. So if you uttered the words, "You are not my husband," that was enough to begin divorce proceedings.
Oh my gosh. Did that ever happen by mistake, you know?
Like a trick.
Well, so someone in disguise comes home and goes, "I've got a great prank for my wife." And she goes, "Oh, you're not my husband." And he goes,
Jesus, I've just divorced my husband. I've done it again.
But the problem was that the punishments for divorce, because although it was possible to do it, it wasn't necessarily something encouraged by the legal system. So if you're looking at Old Babylonia, which is the time of Hammurabi, the great law writer, they had a lot of laws concerning divorce, and men would be fined if they divorced their wives. But in this instance, in this time and place, women would be tied up and thrown into water.
Oh.
So divorce possible, but not really encouraged, especially, you know, if you don't like spending time in sacks underwater.
It's not my favourite thing.
Is that in a sort of effort to punish them, or is it in an effort to kill them? Because I'm not being funny, but if I was tied up in a sack and thrown in a river, I'm not going to surface again. That would be a very expensive divorce for me.
There's another, maybe more extreme punishment in the old Babylonian period for divorce initiated by the woman that might give a bit of context here, which is to be thrown from a tower.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, I'm not sure there's much coming back from that either.
Yeah, I think punishment is a bit of an understatement here. That's straight up execution.
Right. Yeah, that's not great, is it? So technically possible, probably not something that you'll want to be doing, like climbing into a gorilla enclosure.
Probably fatal.
Okay, so I had a triple whammy of fail there where I thought that divorce was going to be impossible in the ancient world. But it sounds actually like you can. I mean, being thrown into a river aside, I'll ignore that bit for now. So we've talked a little bit about women being able to divorce their husbands. And that seems fairly progressive, that women could divorce their husbands just as well as husbands could divorce their wives.
Oh, I wouldn't say just as well for the women of Athens. You have to, if you're a man, as I say, you literally just have to send her home, which is a little bit outrageous. If you're a woman, you have to publicly petition the archon, a public official. You have to go before them. You have to take a male family member from your father's side to support your claim. And you have to say, I need to divorce my husband. Can you do that? This is done like publicly in writing. So it's all very kind of official and formal, whereas obviously a man can just be like, off you go. Pop on home, you're done. So very, very different system. We also have evidence that it's not particularly successful. So one of the only actual sources we have about this process is actually about a woman called Hipparete. And she's Alcibiades' wife. I've talked about Alcibiades quite a lot. Oh, yeah. Absolute legend. Bit of a sexual icon.
Well, obviously not that much of a legend, Meg, if his wife wants to divorce him.
Yeah, no, we're about to cancel him. Actually, he was cancelled in Athens. He's probably the most cancelled man in Athens because he did defect to two different enemies of the state. So anyway, that aside, he also didn't let his wife divorce him because what happened is she went to the Archon and she said, I need to divorce him. And her motive was that he'd brought prostitutes into their house.
Oh my God.
Which is, you know, legally he is totally allowed to visit prostitutes, but to bring a prostitute into her sort of domestic house, that's very, very important, sacred to an Athenian woman.
I'm not going to lie, that's like browsing Tinder in front of your partner.
It's also just like, I think it's so classic.
Bringing prostitutes home.
Bringing, you know, divorcing because of an affair. It's like, have you seen Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow?
But an affair implies that it's, you know, secretive. He's actually bringing people in and going, sorry, babe.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. She didn't even have to miss the tube home. She just literally brought them to her house. Yeah, fair enough. So she goes to the Archon and says, I want to divorce Alcibiades. But then Alcibiades turns up, literally picks her up and carries her away. And apparently that's enough. So she just stops the divorce proceedings and doesn't manage to get divorced. And so I think very few divorces were actually initiated by women. But I do think for ancient Athens, this is actually pretty progressive. Women otherwise have very, very few legal rights. So the fact that they could petition for divorce is pretty good for them.
It's all right. It's better than nothing.
We'll take it.
Yeah. So I'm going to move back to Xenia now, women and getting divorced. Was it as easy as for the men? I think you mentioned that it probably wasn't.
So there were certainly more consequences for women who tried to divorce their husbands. However, I do have quite a fun case, actually, of a divorce.
A fun case of divorce.
Well, it's mainly fun because they do find in favour of the woman, actually. And it's just the whole circumstance is just quite gossipy. And the names are also hilarious. So,
okay, I'm ready.
This woman is called Fania.
Oh dear.
And her husband is called Titinius.
No.
Oh dear.
Heads, shoulders, knees, and toes.
That's their kids' names.
So, Fania was very rich. The sources are quite unclear on this. Either he wanted to divorce her or she wanted to divorce him. But either way, in this whole kind of palaver of a divorce case, Titinius accused her of adultery, of which she was guilty because she literally had an illegitimate son.
Wow.
But Fania still decided to ask for her dowry back, which was quite significant. And Titinius refused because, you know, he said she'd committed adultery.
Gosh.
So then she sued Titinius for the dowry back. Again, very, very, well, not hugely similar, but there are some similarities with the recent case. And then this got escalated, like neither party would budge. So this got escalated up and up and up to a man who was later to become quite famous. He's called Gaius Marius, and he was one of the early dictators of ancient Rome before Julius Caesar. And he at the time was actually a consul. Now, this would be like, I don't know, Boris Johnson deciding a divorce case. However, we've got to bear in mind that in ancient Rome, the legal systems and the political systems were quite like heavily intertwined. Mm-hmm. And you could, like, a great way to become a politician was to go through the courts, a bit like Keir Starmer, I suppose. So he decided to try and use his diplomacy and judicial skills to solve this case. And he actually tried to make Titinius yield to Fannius.
Sorry.
Grow up, Meg.
Haven't we all tried to make Titinius yield? Okay, I'm just going to put myself on mute.
Okay, and you know what? She did end up winning the case, and the reasons cited are brilliant. So Marius ruled that Titinius had just wanted her money all along, and this wasn't actually anything to do with her adultery. It was all about the money. And secondly, he was able to conclude that Titinius knew that Fannia, let's say, enjoyed living life to the full before he married her.
This is too much.
So we've got a loose Fannia all around town.
And a yielding Titinius.
And a yielding Titinius.
So yeah, basically he knew that she was going to commit adultery before he married her, and he married her anyway. And he was like, well, it's your fault, mate.
He was like, you knew what you were in for, and you only wanted her for her money anyway.
Yes, exactly. That's what he concluded. So Fannia came away from that very well off. And actually, the story continues later down the line. Marius was running away because of various political awfulness, and he had to find a safe hideout. Guess where he chose to have his safe hideout?
Fannia's embrace.
I wonder if he granted and he made Titinius yield because he and Fannia were the couple that caused the adultery that ended the relationship in the first place.
Oh, that is extra gossip.
If I had a gossip website in the ancient room, that would be straight on the front page.
I think Caroline Lawrence should do a sort of fan fiction of this.
Yeah, steamy love affair.
Fannia fiction.
Oh!
That was awful, Xenia. That was so bad.
No, that was fantastic. I also had one more follow-up question for you. Does dowry, does that word come from Latin? Do you know what the etymology is? Does it come from do, dare, to give?
Oh, that's a good point. It's a very odd spelling, if so, isn't it? Oh, here we go. Datarium from medieval Latin.
There we go.
Then Anglo-Norman French, duari. I don't know how to say that.
I was getting Norman flower. French, yeah. Lovely.
Yeah.
Meg, I was getting Norman French, yeah.
Good, yeah. I'm glad we all got Norman French from that.
That's so silly.
Is that
silly.
Like a synesthesia thing and you begin to taste Norman French?
I think it's more like she's a psychic and she's like channeling Norman French.
Yeah, Norman French sounds like a guy who would present like Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah, hello, Norman French here with a dowry to present. So we've got Fannia and Titinius, who have normal, not funny names. I heard someone mention Octavius earlier and his three wives. I wondered if you could give me any examples of real couples in the ancient world who ended up getting divorced or breaking up either way.
Oh, yeah. So both Julius Caesar and Octavian had three wives. A lot of these were political marriages. So Julius Caesar first married a woman called Cornelia. And again, she was, you know, from the right kind of family, very kind of traditional marriage. She gave him a daughter called Julia. What's lovely about Caesar and Cornelia's relationship is that when her family kind of fell out of favour, because as I say, this was an incredibly turbulent political time, he refused to divorce her.
But if it's his first wife, surely he did in the end, because he had two others?
No, she died.
Oh.
And Caesar actually gave her a eulogy. Aww. Which is very rare, because women were supposed to be in the private sphere, men were in the public sphere. But so to give her a public eulogy, that was quite the statement.
I don't know. Hadrian named a city after his boyfriend.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, setting the bar quite high for the rest of us.
So then Caesar married someone who was politically expedient for the time, a woman called Pompeia. But, oh, this is quite fun gossip, actually. Through Julius Caesar's role as a priest, she also had these kind of priestessy-like duties, particularly in a festival called the Bona Dea. And a guy called Clodius Pulcher. Now, you know how we were talking about how the final name can sometimes mean something quite funny? Well, his final name means beautiful or handsome. So you can imagine what he looked like. And anyway, so he dressed up as a woman and tried to get into the Bona Dea celebrations, which are supposed to be women only. And it was rumoured that he had an affair with Pompeia, with Julius Caesar's wife. So whether that's true or not, it seems that Caesar thought it was true and divorced her, used that as an excuse to divorce her. So his third wife was Calpurnia. She was actually only a teenager when he married her. And he was routinely unfaithful to her, but she's kind of held up, particularly in later accounts, as like the ideal wife, because she was always faithful. And she's the one in like Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, who's the model grieving wife when he's killed.
It's a bit strange that she's only a teenager. It's a bit, I mean, there's a few male celebrities that I can think of who divorce their partners and then marry younger.
Mm. It was quite common for women to be married quite young. Like, as soon as you hit puberty, you were kind of eligible. So, and the man had to be a bit older. He had to be over 18, actually. But the woman could be really quite young.
And what about women's rights in divorce in the ancient Near East, Barney?
So, interestingly, in the old Babylonian period, wives with children were very well protected by the legal system.
Okay.
Again, maybe in a way that might contravene some of the preconceptions we have about the treatment of women in the ancient world. If a husband does divorce his wife with children, so he initiates it, which obviously he's not going to be massively punished for, she gets the dowry back from their marriage.
Nice.
She gets half of her husband's property, the freedom to raise the children herself. She then benefits from the children's inheritance. And once the children are raised, she'll also have the right to remarry.
Sweet.
So that's moderately similar to sort of what is permitted now. If you avoid the, you know, the chance that if you don't have a child, you get thrown off a tower.
There's always kind of provisos here. And that this is just in one area at one time. To contrast with that old Babylonian example, the old Assyrian example, so just to the north, I don't know if we remember, but generally the old Assyrians are pretty horrid in their treatment of women. Their laws for divorce by the man is a bit more succinct. It's basically, if the man leaves his wife, he doesn't have to give anything other than what he pleases. So if he gives her nothing, she will receive nothing.
What would happen to a woman? Could women get divorced?
I'm pretty sure that's a death.
Right. Okay.
Okay. I mean, you know, I've had boyfriends where I might have chosen that over staying in the relationship. So yeah. I don't know.
Interestingly, there's an old Assyrian contract, so not necessarily a law, but at least a specific contract about a divorce, in which an abused wife might be able to leave her husband.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Greeks have a thing where we're not clear, we don't know from the evidence whether it's an actual legal system or just a kind of custom, but that a woman's father can get her out of a marriage if he thinks she's being mistreated.
Is that against her will, possibly?
That's unclear. So we don't know whether this is basically just, that's a sort of social custom, that if the father asks, the husband has to divorce the wife, or whether that he actually has the legal right to do so, in which case presumably he could do it without her permission. We're not sure from the evidence, but it's quite interesting.
It still feels very sort of, it's very paternalistic still and almost quite transactional. Like, he's protecting part of his estate almost.
It's almost like women in the ancient world were a midpoint between a child and the adult man, where they have more rights than a child might do. Well, in some cases, hopefully. But they also need the permission of a dad or a husband in order to do things.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying the podcast so far, why not support us on Patreon? Our different support tiers can get you merch, shout-outs, and even personalised content. If you want to hear more from Against the Law, find us on Twitter, @AgainstLaw, and we're on Instagram and TikTok. Search for @AgainstTheLawPodcast.
So would you like to hear about a woman who tried to sort of take back control from the men in her life, but with a fairly tragic end?
Oh, okay. Yeah, go on.
you may have heard of her. This is Medea.
Oh my gosh, she's my favourite.
She's your favourite? Celia?
Yeah, she's amazing. Anyway, continue.
Wait. Is this a Medea who had a brother who she killed or something?
She kills, I'll tell you that much.
Okay.
Spoilers. So she's... Medea is our only evidence for the legal process of divorce in tragedy. There's lots of ends of relationships in tragedies, but I'm pretty sure Medea is our only evidence for divorce as a concept. And she was married to Jason of Golden Fleece fame.
As in the Argonauts?
Yeah, Jason and the Argonauts, yeah. Nice. And he decides to get married to, I mean, yeah, again, a tale as old as time. He decides to get married to a princess because he wants to, and it'll improve his social financial position. And that's all the reason he needs. He's just like, I'm going to get married to a princess. And Medea kind of understandably kicks off about this, and her solution to the problem, which honestly fair, is to murder both the new wife. So she poisons Jason's new younger wife. And then to get her revenge against Jason, she thinks, what does he care about most in the world? She thinks it's our children. It's the two children she has with him. So she kills them.
Oh!
Yeah. I mean, it is really interesting because I think in some sort of interpretations of the myth, she's basically held up as just, you know, she's a mad woman. She doesn't love her children. But she, in Euripides' version of the story, the 5th century tragedy, she is devastated. And she's like, this is going to ruin me. This will break my heart to murder my own children. But it's the only way she can see of sort of gaining back some control from Jason.
Sorry, kids.
Yeah. The only thing that will hurt him just as much as
exactly.
She is hurt by what he's done.
Exactly, because she has no legal rights, no power. It's the only way that she can get back at him. So it is, it's obviously not, I wouldn't advocate that, but it is, you can sort of understand her motivations.
Meg advocating for just scorching just everything that you own.
Child murder,
yeah. Get rid of it all. Okay, well, that's nice and depressing. Really mm-hmm. love that. In the ancient Near East, do we have any named individuals who break up or divorce?
One of the breakups that I wanted to mention, not specifically named individuals from reality, but from a myth. And it's not, I wouldn't say this is necessarily a legal divorce, but it is a good story nonetheless, because I feel like it's got an emotional bent, which is the story of Inanna and Dumuzid. And Inanna is the Sumerian name for Ishtar, who's the sort of goddess of love and war, erotic love and war. So she's a sort of violent personality. And she, in this Descent to the Underworld poem, which I think I've mentioned in the past, she takes a trip down to the underworld where Dumuzid is. And because she's entered the underworld, the other gods begin mourning her and, you know, acting the proper way as you would around a funeral. She's now in the land of the dead. And Dumuzid doesn't do that. And she is very angry with him.
But she can see him not mourning her.
Yeah, yeah. She finds him sitting on a throne, lavishly dressed, so not in his proper mourning clothing. And this is the proverbial grounds for divorce, as it were. She gets incredibly angry and sets demons on him, and they drag him down further into the underworld. At which point, she becomes very distressed by what she's done and demands him back. And can no longer find him.
I regret it. I'm sorry.
This is obviously a big simplification of the story, but these are the main beats. But anyway, her sister is the queen of the underworld, and she eventually reaches an arrangement with her that she'll have Dumuzid above ground for half the year, and her sister, Ereshkigal, can have him for the other half of the year. And so it becomes an etiology for the seasons.
Oh, lovely. It's a Persephone-type beat.
Yeah. Was he the god of?
He's a sort of shepherd god.
Okay, so of fertility. It's to do with like crops and things then?
Yeah. Nail on the head.
When he's on Earth, that's summer, and when he's in the underworld, that's winter.
Yeah, that's basically it. it's not like it's not a proper divorce story, but I really like the idea that big mythological wife goes out in search of husband, finds husband doing something that displeases her, gets incredibly angry, banishes him, and then the cycle starts anew as she then begins looking for him.
It's just the concept of going, oh, I might have gone a bit far with that rant, actually. Sorry,
the
babes.
Demons were a bit extreme.
Oh my God, what am I like? Sorry, I was hangry.
You're not you and you're hungry.
I know. So Inanna's the other name for Ishtar then? And she's like,
that's correct.
Sexy violence.
Yes, that, yeah, sexy violence is perfect. She's not the, she's not, yes, romantic love. She's like erotic passion and okay, violent.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense because her relationship isn't like easygoing and chill. So I quite like that she's like volatile and, you know, banishes her husband to the underworld. I mean,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
A sexy move.
If you can't handle me at my
if you can't handle me at my summoning demons, then
you don't deserve me at my making war.
Making war. Right, I'm gonna wrap things up now if everyone's happy. So I'm gonna start with Barney. What's your favourite thing that you've learned on today's podcast?
Yeah. Nice. I love going first. Because that means I can lay claim to Xenia's wonderful tale of Fania.
Yeah.
Which was a wonderful multi-stage drama. And I especially liked how, was it Gaius, did you say, Daniel?
Yeah, Gaius Marius.
Yeah. Ended up, yeah, having to flee to her after his own problems. So it's wonderful. I think miniseries soon come.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, in which case, since Daniel shared that story, Daniel, what was your favourite thing from today?
So I really love Meg's story of Medea. It's always going to be my favourite. I think, especially in the way like Euripides writes about it, the emotions are so intense.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Meg, your favourite thing from today?
Oh, well, I'm very glad Xenia happens to have a passion for Medea, because I think the obvious standout story that I was worried she was going to steal was the summoning of the demons from Barney. I thought that was fantastic.
That was going to be mine. I just like the concept that Inanna's just absolutely front the lid.
Yeah.
Gone, right. Dimazid, you're going to the underworld. Might have overreacted, actually. Mm. Can I have you back, babe? Only
it's so extra as well, because he's already in the underworld and they drag him further down.
Oh, so it's just worse. It's just worse underworld. That's great, guys. Overall, I really like the fact that this went completely in the opposite direction that I was expecting. I didn't think that you could get divorced in the ancient world. So I love that all of you were like, no, I'm immediately going against the law. And I think that's a really good summary of today's episode of Against the Law. And you can catch us next time for our episode on the weather.